Imagine being handed, like, the most important message in human history, and you're told that your only job is to, well, to just drop it in the dirt and go take a nap.
Right. Which is wild to think about.
Totally. I mean, no marketing campaign, no forced conversions. You just plant it and go to sleep. Because usually, when we talk about diving into biblical studies, stepping into that world feels like trying to read a foreign language. Like it's written in this ancient agricultural code, you
Oh,
know?
absolutely. It's so dense.
Yeah, and you feel this intense pressure to decipher everything perfectly just to.
Just to extract a single basic truth, right? You often feel like you need, I don't know, a master's degree in first century Middle Eastern farming practices before you're even allowed to open the text. They can be incredibly intimidating for anyone trying to approach these ancient documents for the first time. You run into these archaic terms, like chaff or threshing floors or yokes.
Stuff we never use today.
Right, and suddenly you feel entirely unqualified to understand what's actually being communicated.
But what if one of the most profound texts in that entire ancient library isn't actually about complex agricultural mastery at all? Like, what if the core message is really just about the immense, overwhelming relief of, you know, letting things grow?
That's the beauty of it.
So today on the Deep Dive, we are looking at an in-depth scholarly analysis of a very short story. It's a parable tucked away exclusively in the Gospel of Mark. Specifically, chapter 4, verses 26 through 29.
Yep, the parable of the growing seed.
Right, the parable of the growing seed. And it doesn't show up in any of the other historical accounts, which I thought was super interesting.
It is. I mean, that isolation in Mark signals something vital to scholars. Usually, major teachings in these texts are mirrored across multiple accounts, right? Like Matthew, Luke, and so on.
Yeah, you see the same stories pop up.
Exactly. So the fact that this particular story sits entirely on its own tells us there's a very specific, isolated point being made here, one that the author of Mark felt was crucial to preserve.
So our mission for you today is to strip away the intimidating theological jargon. We're taking the complex concepts from our source document and basically translating these ancient metaphors into clear, relatable ideas.
Especially if you're totally new to this kind of study.
Right. We want to show you exactly how the mechanics of this text work and why this ancient story is honestly profoundly relevant to how you operate today. So, okay, let's unpack this.
Well, to really understand the mechanics of this story, we first need to define the cast of characters and the tools they're using.
Set the stage.
Right. If you know anything about these ancient parables, you know there are plenty of famous farming stories. But our source document highlights how this particular parable diverges from all the others.
In a pretty major way.
Yeah. Usually, biblical farming stories focus heavily on the condition of the soil. They ask, you know, is the ground rocky? Is it thorny? Or they focus on environmental threats.
Like weeds choking out a young crop.
Exactly. But this one is different.
Yeah, this parable just ignores the rocks and the weeds completely. It zeroes in entirely on the unobservable, unstoppable power of the seed itself.
Which is fascinating.
It really is. So let's decode these metaphors based on the scholarly analysis. First up, we have the seed. Now, in biblical literature, the seed consistently represents the word of God, or, you know, the gospel message.
Right.
And the crucial takeaway here is that this seed possesses inherent life-giving power. Like, it is entirely self-sufficient.
Yeah, the metaphor implies that the message of the kingdom contains its own vitality. I mean, the farmer doesn't have to do anything to, like, activate the seed.
Doesn't power it up.
No, the life is already encoded inside the shell, just waiting to interact with the environment.
So I was reading through this analysis, and that concept of inherent power instantly made me think of a bath bomb.
A bath bomb.
Yeah, hear me out. Like, when you buy a bath bomb, you don't have to assemble the fizz yourself, right? You don't sit on the edge of the tub manually mixing baking soda and citric acid, trying to spark a chemical reaction in the water. The bath bomb has the inherent power to do its thing entirely locked inside of it.
Oh, I see where you're going with this.
Yeah, you just drop it in the water and the fizz is built in.
The chemical reaction is inherent to the object. That analogy actually captures the theology perfectly.
Yeah.
The vitality doesn't come from the person holding the object, it comes from the object itself,
Right.
which drastically shifts how we view the second character in the metaphor, you know, the sower.
Yeah, the sower, which represents the believer, the messenger, or basically simply the person trying to share this spiritual message. If the seed is entirely self-sufficient, if it's the bath bomb, that changes the sower's job description entirely. Like, the sower's only task in this story is to drop the seed.
And the text describes the sower's routine in a way that, frankly, would have sounded almost radical to a first century audience. Well, it says the sower casts the seed and then just sleeps and rises night and day. They just return to ordinary life.
Which doesn't sound like farming at all.
No, not first century farming. That was backbreaking, precarious labor. I mean, if your crop failed, your family starved.
Mm-hmm.
There was this immense pressure to manage every single variable.
Wow.
Okay. The idea of a farmer just dropping seed and going to sleep implies a stunning surrender of control.
They drop the seed, they go make breakfast, they take a nap, they just live their life.
Exactly. The farmer cannot physically stretch a sprout to make it grow faster.
Hmm.
They can't dig their fingers into the dirt and like pull the microscopic roots downward.
Right, that's impossible.
Once the seed is cast, the active role of the sower effectively pauses.
Hmm.
The heavy lifting transitions completely to the seed in the soil.
So the visible action of planting gives way to the invisible subterranean reaction. The sower drops the seed, walks away, and we're left wondering what actually happens in the dark. And our source document notes that this transition is the crux of the entire parable. The text includes this incredible humbling phrase regarding the farmer. It says, "He knows not how."
He knows not how. I love that. Even today, with electron microscopes and time-lapse photography, the sheer mechanics of a dormant dry seed suddenly absorbing moisture, bursting open and pushing life upward against gravity. I mean, it's staggering.
It's totally wild.
But for a first century farmer who didn't even know what a biological cell was, it was pure, unadulterated mystery. They stood above ground, completely ignorant of the biological fireworks happening an inch below their feet.
They are entirely blind to the process. And our source notes that spiritually, this points directly to the hidden work of the Holy Spirit.
Right.
Which honestly brings up a massive psychological point for us today. Because we live in a culture that hates knowing not how.
Oh, absolutely.
Like if a toddler isn't hitting a milestone, we buy 10 books and track their development on an app. If a project at work stalls, we micromanage the spreadsheets. We want a dashboard for everything.
We really do. We're conditioned to believe that if we aren't managing the growth, growth isn't happening. But what's fascinating here is that Jesus uses a very specific Greek word in this text to shatter that illusion.
Oh, the Greek word. Yeah, let's get into that.
He describes the process using the word automatra. He says the earth produces crops by itself. And that Greek word automatra is literally the root of our English word automatic.
Automatic. So the process operates completely independent of the farmer's anxiety. It just happens.
Exactly. When the seed representing the gospel interacts with the soil representing the human heart, God's grace operates organically and autonomously.
Okay, wait, wait. Let me challenge that for a second.
So go ahead.
Wait, if the soil is doing this automatically, doesn't that mean we just sit back and do nothing? Like, what is the actual point of the sower if the dirt and the seed do all the heavy lifting?
That is the perfect question, and it's exactly the tension this parable is getting at. The parable is designed to hold two seemingly contradictory ideas in perfect tension. You have profound human limitation alongside the absolute necessity of human participation.
Okay, so the limitation is that we can't trigger the cellular biology, we can't force the growth, but the participation means we still have to get our hands dirty to get the seed into the ground in the first place.
Precisely. Think about it. A seed sitting on a shelf in a barn does not interact with the soil. It remains completely dormant.
It's a bath bomb still in the plastic wrap.
Yes, perfect. The necessity of human participation is the physical act of scattering. You are the delivery mechanism. You must carry the message to the soil.
Right.
But once it's planted, your limitation takes over. You do not own the miracle of the germination.
The sower is relegated to their proper role. We are just the delivery mechanism.
Yep.
Because, I mean, if you care deeply about someone and you are desperate for them to experience spiritual growth or understand a truth you shared with them, the temptations to dig up the dirt every 5 minutes to see if the seed is doing anything.
Oh, we've all done that. You want to force the subterranean biology.
Exactly. But knowing that the growth is automata relieves the sower of an impossible burden. You don't have to play God.
No, you step back and enter the most difficult phase of the entire agricultural cycle.
The waiting.
The waiting. Because even when the biology finally works and a plant breaks the surface, the story is far from over.
Yeah, a green shoot isn't a harvest. You can't survive on a blade of grass.
Definitely not.
Our exegesis document breaks down this waiting game by highlighting a very specific progression that Jesus describes for spiritual maturity. The theological term for this process is sanctification.
Right, sanctification.
It is the long, often agonizingly slow process of growing spiritually mature, and the parable breaks it into three distinct mechanical stages: the blade, the ear, and the full grain.
Right, so the text starts with the blade. This is that vulnerable first sprout finally breaking through the crust of the dirt.
The very beginning.
Agriculturally, it's tiny, it's fragile, and it barely resembles the mature wheat it's destined to become. Spiritually, our source identifies this as initial faith. It's the moment of repentance. It represents the very first delicate, almost imperceptible signs of spiritual life in a person.
It's the moment the farmer can finally exhale and say, okay, something is actually happening down there.
Exactly.
But, you know, you can't harvest a blade. It has zero nutritional value. It's just a fragile green ribbon in the wind. So what has to happen next in this underground process to actually get us to a crop?
Well, the plant must transition into the second stage, which is the ear. This is where the structure of the plant begins forming. The stalk grows taller, taking its defining shape, but it's still entirely green and, crucially, it's empty.
Empty.
Yeah, there was no grain inside the head yet.
So it sounds like the awkward teenage phase of the plant's life cycle.
That is exactly what it is. The framework is establishing itself, but the substance hasn't fully materialized. But think about the structural mechanics of a stalk of wheat.
Okay.
That awkward empty phase is doing incredibly vital work. It's building cellulose. It's developing the fiber structural integrity required to actually hold a heavy, dense head of grain later on.
Oh, I see.
If you somehow magically attached a full, heavy head of mature wheat to a tiny, newly sprouted blade, the stalk would instantly snap under the weight. It would just collapse into the mud.
Wow. So the sanctification process requires structural reinforcement. The plant has to spend time just getting strong enough to handle maturity.
Yes, precisely.
In the spiritual metaphor, our source aligns this ear phase with the development of biblical understanding, the slow building of character, and the forging of personal discipline. Like, the believer is learning and taking shape, but they aren't fully mature yet.
They're building the spiritual cellulose needed to withstand the weight of actual responsibility, which finally leads to the third stage, the full grain in the ear.
The ultimate goal.
Right. The mature, heavy head of wheat. It's golden, dense, and ready to provide actual sustenance. Spiritually, this represents full maturity, or what the wider biblical text calls bearing the fruit of the Spirit.
Okay, so what does this all mean? Like, taking these mechanical stages, the blade, the structurally necessary ear, and the full grain, what does this actually mean for you and me when we interact with other people?
It demands a radical adjustment of our expectations regarding the people around us.
Yeah, our source document makes a remarkably poignant observation here. We should never expect full grain behavior from a blade believer.
It's so true. We constantly look at someone who has just begun their spiritual journey, someone who is just a tiny, vulnerable blade, and we judge them harshly because they aren't producing the heavy, mature grain of a person who has been growing through decades of structural trials.
Right. We get frustrated that the awkward, empty green ear isn't yielding a harvest yet.
We want a microwave sanctification. We want instant spiritual maturity.
But spiritual growth is fundamentally a process of time. It's inextricably linked to the passage of days and seasons.
Yeah, the farmer who sleeps and rises night and day is not just being lazy. They are allowing the necessary ingredient of time to do its work.
The time is required.
Absolutely. The days and nights must pass for the blade to survive, for the ear to build its structural integrity, and for the full grain to finally ripen.
So the growth phase requires this long, slow, agonizing patience. But our source points out a dramatic shift in the narrative. Because what happens the second the plant actually reaches full maturity stands in stark contrast to all that slow waiting.
It really does.
Mm-hmm.
The parable concludes with a jarring shift in tempo. The slow, rhythmic sleeping and rising abruptly ends. The grain ripens, and immediately the farmer puts the sickle to it.
The imagery of the sickle and the harvest. Our source notes that this imagery draws heavily from the Old Testament, specifically the book of Joel, chapter 3, verse 13.
Yes.
But, like, if you aren't a biblical scholar, a passing reference to Joel probably flies right over your head. Why does this Old Testament connection matter so much to the story?
Because for the original first century Jewish audience, that reference would have hit like a thunderclap.
Yeah.
Oh, yeah. Joel 3.13 talks about putting in the sickle because the harvest is ripe. And in that cultural context, the sickle was shorthand for the day of the Lord.
Oh, okay.
It represented the final judgment, the ultimate culmination of God's redemptive plan for human history. By invoking the sickle, Jesus instantly elevates a sleepy, mundane farming tale into an apocalyptic promise.
It raises the stakes to a cosmic level. And the pacing of that climax is fascinating, because throughout the entire parable, the farmer has been entirely passive.
Sleeping, waking, watching.
And right, completely ignorant of how the biology is actually functioning.
Hmm.
But the text says the moment the grain is full, at once he puts in the sickle. The action becomes decisive and immediate.
The waiting is agonizingly slow, but the final harvest is incredibly sudden. When the kingdom reaches its appointed maturity, the divine action is conclusive. There's no more waiting around.
So connecting this apocalyptic sickle imagery to the passive farmer brings us to the core theological theme of the entire analysis. Our source identifies this as the ultimate tension between human limitations and divine sovereignty.
Exactly. If we connect this to the bigger picture, consider the original audience listening to this parable. They were a small, marginalized, heavily persecuted group of believers trying to spread a brand new spiritual message against the insurmountable odds of the Roman Empire.
Right. They were facing execution, imprisonment, and societal exile.
They were holding a tiny seed while staring at a massive hostile field.
That's a great way to put it.
And if the success of this entirely new kingdom depended on their own human cleverness, you know, their ability to manipulate the soil, outsmart the Romans, or somehow force the seed to grow through sheer willpower, it would be a shockingly fragile kingdom. It would almost certainly fail.
Because humans are notoriously terrible at managing complex systems without eventually messing them up due to, well, ego, exhaustion, or just plain ignorance.
We are weak, we get tired, and as the parable explicitly points out, we are profoundly ignorant of how real transformation even happens.
He knows not how.
Exactly.
Yeah.
By placing the life-giving power entirely locked within the seed itself, and by making the growth in the soil fully automa, the teaching guarantees that God's kingdom is going to succeed entirely, regardless of human weakness or failure.
So the kingdom's success isn't riding on the fragile shoulders of the sower. It succeeds because the seed has inherent power, and because a sovereign force oversees the final harvest.
The pressure is lifted off the marginalized audience. The success of the message is guaranteed by the nature of the seed, not the skill of the farmer.
That is the ultimate takeaway of this scholarly deep dive. I mean, it takes an intimidating ancient text and reveals a message of immense practical relief.
Relief is the perfect word for it.
So let's bring this directly back to you, listening right now. Why should a first century farming story matter to your daily life?
Good question.
Because whether you are exploring faith for the very first time, or whether you are someone who has been anxiously trying to share your worldview with a stubborn friend or family member for years, the pressure is off.
The anxiety of having to manufacture a result is entirely removed from your shoulders.
We've stripped down these metaphors to their core mechanics. You have the inherent bath bomb-like power of the seed. The unexplainable automata subterranean growth happening in the dark. The structurally vital, painfully slow stages of maturity, from the fragile blade to the awkward ear to the heavy grain. And finally, the sudden, decisive cosmic harvest. The thread tying all of this together is that your sole responsibility is just faithful planting.
You provide the environment. The divine provides the growth.
You do not have to be a master biologist to drop a seed in the dirt. You do not have to be a master debater or a brilliant theologian to share a profound message. You just faithfully drop the seed into the soil of a human heart, and you let it do exactly what it was designed to do.
It really is a profound invitation to actually rest, to literally sleep and rise night and day, with the deep-seated confidence that the invisible work is still happening, even when you aren't actively managing or tracking it on a dashboard.
But, you know, that concept of resting brings up a fascinating dilemma for how we live today.
Oh, absolutely.
We want to leave you with a final thought to mull over, something that bridges this ancient agricultural world with our modern reality, because our source document makes it undeniably clear that the seed grows automatically based on its interaction with the soil of the human heart.
Yeah.
And we know that this essential growth happens during the quiet passage of time. The mundane moments when the farmer is just sleeping and rising, living an ordinary, unhurried life.
The quiet, unmanaged moments are structurally essential for that automata process to function.
So here is the question for you to explore on your own. How might our modern, hyper-distracted, entirely digital world be changing the fundamental condition of our soil?
That's a challenging thought.
If genuine spiritual and personal growth requires the slow, quiet passage of time, What happens to the seed when we never allow ourselves a single moment of true, unplugged quiet?
Yeah, if we're constantly plugged in.
Exactly. If we never truly just sleep and rise without a screen glowing in our faces, constantly stimulating our minds and managing our anxieties, are we actually giving the seed the dark, silent space it needs to automatically grow?
Because when the noise never stops, the soil never rests.
Give that some thought today as you go about your routine. Thanks for joining us on this deep dive.